right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again talking more Winners at War. Dom, Winners at War, officially episode 3, I believe. We do not need to begin for yet another week arguing over the episode number, but how are you doing today?
I think you just did, actually, but I'm great. I'm excited and also a little nervous because I think this is the moment that my podcasting career has been building towards for the past 8 years. This is the week I finally get canceled.
Oh, interesting. I can't wait. Are you going to let us know how you're getting canceled at the top of the show, or is that like a tease for at some point during this podcast you're going to unleash your hottest and perhaps least woke take of all time?
Oh, I'm not going to bury the lead and just, you know, bust out a slur 70 minutes into the episode. No, I seem to be the only person on planet Earth who is not heartbroken that Ethan went home and did not even go home, Colin. He went to the edge of extinction, which is, some would say, even worse.
I mean, you are clearly psychotic and should be jailed for that take, but we will certainly get there a little later on. But curious to hear why it is you are not an Ethan fan, like seemingly pretty close to 100% of other Survivor fans. And I guess a spoiler alert on episode 3, if you have not seen that episode, we will be getting into all of the events that went down. But
just on that, do you think it would be an exaggeration to say that Ethan is the most universally beloved Survivor of all time?
So I have explored this topic in the past, and based on an in-depth series of Twitter polls, by which I mean I did 2 hastily thrown together Twitter polls, the top 2 for me have always seemed pretty clear in terms of just no one other than apparently Dom has a single bad word to say about either of these people after all these years, and those are Ethan and Ceri Fields, I would say, are the runaway top 2 most universally beloved Survivors.
Yeah, I would definitely get on board with that. And with Ceri, it can be a little controversial sometimes, just because if gameplay gets brought into it, people argue, like, should she have won Micronesia over Parvati? And then how good is she, you know, across the totality of all of her seasons? So when you get deep in the weeds on gameplay, then maybe there's a little bit to argue about. But no one even cares about Ethan's gameplay. They just love him anyway.
I don't want to distract from the main focus of this podcast, because I did not know we were going to be spending a ton of time berating Ethan this week. I thought you would be on roughly the same page. Maybe I've just been overlooking all of your anti-Ethan takes over the years. But
hey, I'll be the one berating Ethan, and you'll be the one berating me for not being madly in love with Ethan.
Okay, I mean, I'm certainly not going to be coming in here saying, oh, Ethan was robbed. We'll get to it. But that is definitely a solid enough kind of tease for the top of the podcast. If people are able to get past your objectively terrible taste and are willing to not just immediately shut this podcast off.
Yeah, this is a good mechanism for weeding out the weak. You know, if you heard that take and you're still here and you're still alive, then it's only uphill from now.
Yeah, and so, all right, let's get into things here, Dom. Officially episode 3, I'm going to say, and we could have not begun the last 2 podcasts debating that situation if you just agreed with me in the first place. So perhaps jot that down for future reference, but here we go. So we get this music at the top of the show that we have heard in season 40 promos. It has come to my attention. This is Sia. And I was wondering if we'd ever had music on Survivor make it into an episode before that had like actual lyrics. I enjoyed it, but it felt almost foreign to have English words in a song on Survivor.
That absolutely stood out to me too, but now that I know that it's Sia, which is a connection I did not make at the time, everything has slotted into place. It all makes perfect sense now.
My awareness of Sia has gone up 10,000% because of Survivor, so I guess job well done and potentially money well spent by her, but yeah, that absolutely tracked. I didn't know initially that it was Sia. I thought it was a good music choice just for this season, but yeah, Sia. Prior to her involvement on Survivor, I had certainly seen the name, but in my head, I was pronouncing it Sia for like 5 years. I was blown away when Jeff Probst called her Sia.
You'd see in the name?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, beautiful. Yes, well, Sia is going like full Mike Bloomberg in terms of her advertising strategy here, and it seems to be paying off. You know, she's become a staple of the franchise, and I'm not going to diminish her musical ability by saying that she only has one song, but it's usually pretty noticeable when you're listening to Sia. So that's my bad that I wasn't able to find that immediately.
So I know she has a song either called Chandelier or about a chandelier, but that is the extent of my Sia music knowledge, unfortunately.
And Chandelier, and maybe this is a hot take too, is fucking awful. I mean, maybe it's not a bad song, it's just that it is the go-to song for any like retail environment, any like top 40 playlist. If you turn on the radio at the wrong time, your channel surf, you are guaranteed to hear it at least once on any of those occasions.
Okay. It's been a minute since I've been listening to much top 40 radio, but maybe that day will come. I did think, though, that, yeah, in knowing that this is Sia, and also just seeing Sia-ing the recent campaign, I guess, to end Edge of Extinction, put on by Josh Wigler and company, like, genuinely, the route that they tried to go at a certain point was, let's get in touch with the rich and famous people that watch this show and see if they can influence Jeff Probst, because clearly the people are not getting through to him. And it really is a pretty solid metaphor for just how the world, at least America, is working right now.
Josh Wigler really went out of his way to light a bridge on fire with either Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon, not quite sure which one. But either way, you know, I salute Josh for being willing to put himself out there like that.
You know what's incredible to me is the fact that both your boy, Dom, John Oliver, and another British guy, James Corden, are two of the like five or six late night talk show hosts here in America that are like immensely famous now, and neither of them was even remotely well known in England, right?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I mean, I was not remotely well known in England either, and I'm still a wireless celebrity over here. So
you're right on pace. You leave England and then you're going to ascend here in America. So very much looking forward to your eventual late night talk show. And I'm just hoping I can be the Andy Richter figure there. I doubt you know who Andy Richter is, so sorry.
Hey, you knew me before I was cool. Not that I'm ever going to be cool, you understand, but just in case that's a possibility. You were in there on the ground floor.
Yes. All right. I think we have sufficiently wasted enough time here, Dom, because this episode, right away, not just with the Sia music, but the tension was palpable immediately, and at least for me, and I'm guessing this was the case for many other people, the stakes just right off the bat became so high. As, you know, it opens on this fun kind of scene of Rob, like, messing with Adam, poking his nose with the leaf as he's sleeping, and it starts out, you know, cute enough and low-key enough, but genuinely, within the first 2 minutes of this episode, I was just about having a heart attack, and I did not do a great job of regaining my breath at pretty much any point along the way here, just because immediately after this kind of fun opener, right away, it seems like Adam and Rob are going to war, and I have been a huge advocate for the way Adam plays Survivor and thinks about Survivor, and at least from time to time, a bit critical, perhaps, of Boston Rob along the way, and when Adam got the quote immediately saying, Boston Rob needs to be in control all the time, but this isn't Redemption Island, this is Winners at War. At that point, I was saying, okay, I agree with that, I think this could be good for Adam, but he goes on to say, he needs to adapt and play a little more like I am. And at that point, Dom, I just was choking the entire episode. I could not breathe.
Boston Rob needs to adapt or he'll be vetted out. And in the end, only one will remain to claim the $1 million prize. That's just how this thing goes.
I loved a lot of these impulses from Adam, but so many of the confessionals just made me extraordinarily nervous. So
just touching on the Sia music quickly. This really set the tone for the entire episode, and I loved how cinematic this episode felt. Like, it's not just a bunch of isolated scenes that we're going to draw some connections between as we skip along various parts of the story. This was a production. This was a full 42-minute viewing experience, and they established that right from the outset.
I definitely agree with that. And one other thing, along at least similar lines, and I'm not sure when else this would come up, but now seems like a reasonable enough time, once again, they are going with some unconventional, like, camera angles and editing techniques on Edge of Extinction in particular. And I don't know why they are limiting it, at least for now, to there. Maybe it's so it's like it's visually distinct and you can notice the difference, but I would love it if they would work more of that into the main story as well. I think a lot of that has been really effective, and I don't know why we are why Edge of Extinction gets to hog all of that.
You want close-ups of their faces at all times?
Not even the mega close-up constantly being worked in, but things like that, at least from time to time, being attempted, and I'm sure not all of it is going to stick, but I think that could be effective. It, you know, after watching this show for 20 years, I do think that visually, I guess, mixing things up a bit more would be a shot worth taking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all right. So certainly plenty more on this Adam and Rob dynamic over the course of this episode, but just right away, I was watching live. I was planning on, like, live tweeting thoughts along the way, but I was just crippled from this opening scene and was not going to be able to move until I saw the final result. So, all right, let's hold off on all of that drama for the time being. Dom, we get a segment over on the other team about Sandra and the approach she's taking this time around. She wants to, now that it's her fourth time playing, fifth time as a person on a season of Survivor, and this is the last one, she's going to retire after this. She wants to show that there's more to her than floating in the background and betraying people, and she can be out here hacking it in the physical way and the survival way as well. She sets up this kind of fishing net. She and the several other people are involved, but she seems to get the bulk of the credit here for this idea for the fishing net. And ultimately, this is going to help the tribe catch a shark, which seems to provide quite a good meal for them, and it certainly provides a great scene with Tony pulling it out of the net. But what did you make of Sandra, I guess 4.0 or 5.0, suddenly caring about the actual survival element?
Look, hey, this isn't Pearl Islands or Heroes vs. Villains or Game Changers or Island for the Idols. This is Survivor Winners at War, so she's adapting.
I mean, I guess in the karmic sense, if we go back to Pearl Islands, she did throw away the tribe's whole fish supply, so she's kind of just repaying the universe here with this delicious shark dinner.
Yeah, it took 13 years, but she's finally found redemption.
So here's a question for you, because this was something I managed to avoid for quite some time, but ultimately it did cross my desk, I suppose. Have you heard the Baby Shark song, Dom?
I have, of course.
Okay, it would not have surprised me if you said, no, I've heard of it, but I've never heard the song itself.
As a millennial of a certain age and disposition, of course I've heard the Baby Shark song. Like, who are you kidding?
As also a millennial in this day and age,
I guess in the looser sense, yes.
I graduated high school in 2005, Dom. I'm overtly, objectively a millennial. I had never even heard of it until I was with a friend of mine who is like a first grade teacher, and she couldn't believe that I'd never heard of the Baby Shark song and played it for me, and it was so good seeing Tony give his rendition of it, including the Sandra Shark remix. A lot of great stuff here, and staying with this tribe, while we do see Sandra get a pretty positive kind of segment here, overall, I would say, we also, along the way, get Tyson kind of, at least attempting to, put a bit of a target on her, telling Sophie and Yule that, you know, look at what this tribe has become. As is often the case with Sandra, she's just spreading misinformation to divide us, and Yule will bring this information back to Sandra, and she gets a confessional like, oh, Tyson better not be throwing my name around. But it does still seem at least noteworthy to me that what little we are seeing of this red tribe does still revolve around people at least being nervous about Sandra.
And that's going to be a constant for as long as Sandra is in any season of Survivor, excuse me. And it's impressive how so many of these big targets coming in have been able to seemingly successfully minimize that threat level so far. Like, we haven't heard a whisper about Sarah, even though she's, you know, skulking around, going on investigative missions at night. She's reinstating Cops R Us. Sarah does not seem to be on anyone's radar, even though she was the number one target, maybe, of everyone coming in. And then I guess there are so many big targets this season that some of them just mathematically have to fly under the radar for a bit. And if we were being uncharitable, Colin, if we were, you know, if this weren't the season of positivity, we might say Sandra is one of those. But she generally does seem to be a good job of ingratiating herself and integrating herself.
I mean, if we go back to the many, many hours of preseason podcasting we did, I remember describing a certain tier of players as the threat level midnight tier, where there's just nothing they can ever do to have the enormous target not almost implicitly just be on them. And I think that group for me was Sandra, Rob, Tony, and probably Parvati, and all four of them are still in the game. I obviously could be going better for a couple of them, but that's incredible to me that none of the four of them have left in the first four episodes. I definitely would have bet against that.
For sure, yeah. And I guess now that we've cut some of the fat away, there are only big eliminations left. And, you know, it's weird to say that, like, Ethan or Danny or like Natalie are not momentous eliminations, but in the grand scheme of things, that's kind of what it feels like. And it's weird that we have to put ourselves in that mindset now.
So not only do you not care about Ethan being eliminated, you also think he's fat?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I thought it was funny, and at least I didn't pick up on this until rewatching it, but as I was initially viewing this episode, one of the couple of things that I did manage to tweet, because this was a big win for you here, Dom, not only is Tony calling her Sandra the way you pronounce it, Yule starts calling her Sandra as well. So the Dom pronunciation catching on a bit. But I noticed when rewatching, as I said, that initially Yule is calling her Sandra, and then it's not until a little later on that he starts pronouncing it Sandra. And genuinely, if I were Sandra in that spot, I would be saying, what the hell is Tony saying to me about you? Because the only way you would be pronouncing it Sandra is if you have recently heard Tony using it that way a lot.
That's an amazing, like, pronunciation tell, right?
I'm not even kidding. I swear to you, he's pronouncing it in that moment because he has recently been talking with Tony about Sandra.
I completely agree with you. And we had some poverties in this episode, too. Like, it was a real banner week for odd pronunciations.
I mean, I don't know what
Is it pronunciations or pronunciations?
Pronunciations is what I go with. But, yeah, particularly Ben. Although, I mean, Jeff Probst still does not accurately pronounce Parvati. He calls her Parverti with, like, two R's in there. Ben calls her just outright Poverty, which I get. Like, it's not entirely Ben's fault. Poverty sounds a lot like the word poverty, and if you didn't know her from her original seasons, I would get making that mistake. But we're on, like, day 9 or whatever here. Maybe this is not a producer's job to step in and say, by the way, dude, her name is not Poverty. Her name is Parvati. But someone needs to correct Ben on this.
Alternatively, no one needs to correct anybody because we know, like, we all know what her name is. And he clearly is trying to pronounce it, but just that's the way he says things. That's his accent. And it's different phonemes or whatever are coming out, and that's fine. No one cares.
Don't connect this to yourself. This is not a situation where you could correctly spell the word for me. Ben thinks her name is Poverty. That is what's going on.
Look, I know it's not fashionable to do this, but give Ben just like one tiny iota of credit.
I would dare say, at least in the scope of season 40, no one has been a more staunchly pro-Ben Dreebergen podcast for these last 2.5 weeks.
I think a lot of that is me being open-minded and fair and judicious, as I always am.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of just this little moment of drama we got here on the Red Tribe, where we have this kind of game of telephone of gunning for Tyson and then Yule reporting it back, or excuse me, Tyson gunning for Sandra and then Yule reporting it back? Any major takeaways there? Anyone you felt like we were meant to feel like did a good or bad job in particular?
I don't think that they like buried Tyson or anything, or made him look like an idiot for making that move or saying that to Yule, because Tyson knows that he's on the outs and he needs something to change for him to be in a good spot. And maybe what that all that has to change is the tribe that he's on. And this is going to be a factor when we talk about the decision that Rob and Adam's tribe made. But if I was out there, I would be a little surprised if they hadn't swapped already. And 100% absolutely convinced that a swap is coming in the imminent future, in the very next vote. So maybe that's what Tyson has to do. Maybe Tyson just has to not step on any toes and not make any unforced errors, of which this could be a perfect example. And he'll be set. But maybe he thinks, well, if there is a swap, it's even more important that I assert myself now. If I can get Sandra out of the game, then that is one less massive variable that I have to contend with going into that swap. And it's going to be much easier for me to find my footing again.
I am very glad and proud of you, Dom, that you brought that up, because when we get to the Adam and Rob situation, that is the number one consideration for me. Is I promise you, Adam Klein was doing a lot of this because he is a Survivor super fan and could immediately tell you that there has not been a season without a swap after at least the first four votes since like 2011. I think South Pacific was the last time that they went beyond four votes without a swap. And I think that explains a ton of Adam's behavior and priorities over the course of this next round.
Yeah, although you could also apply the same logic to him. It's right now, maybe you're in a little bit of a tricky situation, but just don't get voted out, and the sky's the limit. You don't have anything to worry about.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. So quickly, before we, I guess, get into the blue team and all of the ensuing drama from their vote, let's quickly check in here on Edge of Extinction. We get a scene of Danny going spearfishing, which I wrote down just because if we are looking for the next Chris Underwood, we've already checked off the third voted out box. I feel like all we really saw of him looking good on Edge of Extinction was some small scene of him spearfishing. So at least we can check that box as well, Dom, and leave the door open for Danny being the next Chris Underwood.
Would you love to see it if that were the case?
I wouldn't hate to see it. I do think it would be fascinating to have Danny Boatwright play the most under-the-radar winner game in the history of Survivor. No one ever thinks she's going to come back again. She finds herself in the situation she is hypothesized about for a decade plus, saying, I would only come back for all winners. She is in a good spot. It goes horrifically wrong. She goes invisible again and then sneaks in through Edge of Extinction on day 36 to win $2 million in the all-champion season. I think that would be Chris Underwood on crack, and I think I would love to see it.
Yeah, it's the beauty of a season like this, that almost any narrative you can build is compelling in some way. So it's not that I would hate to see it, it's that I would love to see basically any other outcome more at this point.
Well, it seems to me, Natalie Anderson seems to have, at least through these first three episodes, a hammerlock on everything going on here at Edge of Extinction. Once again, she is going to scoop an advantage. This time, it is a steal a vote that she is going to give to Sarah Lucina, where Sarah, I guess, technically doesn't necessarily get the steal a vote. She's going to have to infiltrate the enemy camp to pick it up, which is a fun scene we will get to. But it really seems like yet another week of Edge of Extinction being mostly about Natalie. And we talked last week about how being the first one there in particular, but just the earlier you get there, the earlier you get to adjust to what life on the edge is like and the way the mini games work and the collecting the fire tokens and everything like that. At this point, I feel like I would bet on Natalie Anderson to win one of the reentry challenges, maybe not the final six one, but the merge in particular. I feel like just given the control she seems to have had over Edge of Extinction and the advantages she will have entering that challenge, you'd be crazy not to bet on Natalie against the field right now.
Yeah, over under 1.5 Edge of Extinction return challenges won by Natalie Anderson.
Yeah, if it's a revolving door where she comes in at the merge, leaves again quickly, and then gets to go back and collect more fire tokens, yeah, maybe.
Sure. It's going to be interesting to see how they actually balance that return challenge, though, because if you have either several different advantages spread through different people, or maybe just one person piling up all of them, then you don't want that to be a done deal from the outset. You want it to be something that, in theory, I guess not anyone could win because that's just impossible, but something that going in, it's like, okay, I could see a few different outcomes happening. And if Natalie just has a lock on it from the outset, then the entire point of Edge of Extinction seems to disappear.
I am also going to be curious about if there's any sort of like transferring of fire tokens on Edge of Extinction from one person to another, or if they can like see the challenge and then decide, oh, I'm drawing dead to win, let me give my fire tokens to Natalie so she can buy an idol in the event that she gets back in, things like that. I'm going to be nervous until I see it go the other way, that whoever re-enters the game at Final Six is going to just be completely loaded with items off the advantage menu.
Yeah, they will be way down, barely able to move with all of the like assorted Ghost Island necklaces and whatever that they've inherited over 36 days.
It also could be interesting because I don't believe we've seen anyone buy anything other than these Edge of Extinction advantages with their fire tokens in the main game, and I also don't believe we've seen anything other than potentially the eye sockets on the immunity idol in terms of ways for people to earn more fire tokens who are in the main game. I was anticipating that being a regular thing, of being able to earn fire tokens somehow. I don't know how, but I thought that would play a big role, the same way Garnets do on the Genius within the main game, and so far, at least, that does not appear to be the case.
Yeah, maybe that helps the case of someone like Jeremy even further, where not only does he know kind of how the details on this advantage pipeline between the main game and this sub-game on Edge of Extinction, but he also knows just how scarce or scarce, possibly, these fire tokens actually are. Where once you've had the opportunity to bid on items and you've seen how often that happens and the rate that certain things command, you have a pretty good sense of like what you need to hold your fire tokens for. And I wonder how long it's going to be before we see someone just turn down something that they're offered through that mechanism.
That's what I was going to say, is she does not necessarily know this, and she doesn't know what better prizes have been up for grabs the first couple times around. But with the full knowledge that we have, I have no issue Monday morning quarterbacking Sarah Lucina here into wondering if a steal of vote is necessarily worth giving up your one fire token when it does seem like it may actually be a little harder to come by these things in the future.
Yeah, the tough thing is, though, is that you have over 15 people left in the game at this point. How often are you specifically going to receive the chance to even bid on something like this? Like, it's one thing if you're at like the auction, let's say, and you're everyone is holding their dollars close to their chest, waiting for the perfect time. You don't know if there's going to be another time. Maybe this is the perfect and the only time to spend your money.
I agree with that, and I also think there is going to be an element of not just I want to make the producers happy, but as she lays out, like, this is season 40. I came here to go balls to the wall and make every attempt I could at putting myself in a powerful position. And I do understand the inclination to say yes here. I just, setting aside a lot of very understandable kind of human considerations, I do wonder if just like, I know there is no mathematical value for a steal of vote. It's impossible to place any kind of exact weight on how important that could be. It just, I am getting the sense at this point that one fire token would be more important entering next week than a steal a vote that is extremely difficult to use correctly, even though she has, at least as she would tell it, a history of using it correctly, although I believe she just used it unnecessarily.
I don't know if you're there in Sarah's position, how much credit you give the producers in terms of assigning the right costs to all of the different items. Like, you might think that one fire token should be worth a certain amount in this economy that they're building, but you don't know if they've calibrated that properly, right? So your one fire token can mean so much more or so much less than you can even know.
Right. I think they would have a next to impossible time really understanding the true value of a fire token, as do we right now, in terms of what it is eventually going to be worth and how these things are eventually going to play out. It's more like fire Bitcoin, as far as I can tell, where it is going to be super volatile, but being a savvy investor could easily pay off immense dividends down the line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of this scene where she enlists some backup from her Cops R Us buddy Tony here to help her inexplicably blackface herself before going to invade the other team's camp and get her advantage here? I didn't really think there was a possibility that she would get caught, but I actually do feel like one thing that could make me really excited about this sort of thing being apparently a staple now is feeling like it is at least possible that they could get caught. And I would love it to have a season sometime in the future. I'm guessing they will keep doing this where someone has to sneak into the other tribe. I will be very, very happy, no matter who it happens to down the line, when someone hopefully eventually gets caught doing this. I think that will be huge for the show to make it clear this is not just a gimme.
Yeah, this is not free. On the other hand, what are the consequences going to be, right? Like, if this does become normalized, then everybody understands that if you're the lucky person who gets offered this opportunity, of course you're going to take it. And so it's not like you have broken any kind of like trust or anything. Like, you're just doing what you came here to do.
I think the consequences are now this entire team is going to know you have an advantage on the other side. I think that's a fair consequence. Like, what I want is to know that that consequence is actually realistically in play.
Well, the thing is they, I don't know if there's some penalty clause attached where if they catch you, you don't get it. Cause it seems to be, at least with Vince, I thought that was the case where last season, where if he got caught, he wouldn't end up getting it at all. So that almost removes the consequence where if you get caught, then you don't have the advantage, and so there's nothing for them to know about you.
Yeah, I would definitely not have an issue with that either. I just think it would be a fascinating scene. The same way, you know, not a ton of things about Survivor Cook Islands stand out in my memory. No disrespect to Yule and Parvati, of course, but one of the craziest things to me was when Cowboy and a couple other people walked to the other tribe's camp to try to get like some spices from them, and they just showed up on their beach. And I certainly also remember not too many highlights from Survivor One World, but one of the things I definitely recall podcasting about and praising when we were in here talking about that in real time was just how cool it was to have both tribes on the same beach, and you'd be seeing some on-the-fly shot of a couple of the women having some conversation, and then a couple of people in different colored buffs would just walk by in the background. It was awesome, and I'm definitely here for that sort of thing.
Yeah, any kind of mall-style espionage on Survivor, I'm here for. Smuggle that in as much as you can.
Definitely. All right, so very good stuff there from Sarah with some help from Tony. Interested to see if that ultimately ends up playing a role, just because I understand the appeal of steal a vote on paper, as has been noted many times, it is just very difficult to execute in a manner where it's a situation like, okay, without this steal a vote, it would have gone one way, but because I utilized this masterfully, it swung everything. In conclusion, I would rather have the fire token, but I get it. All right, so let's get into, Dom, I guess, this immunity challenge. Another obstacle course followed by a puzzle, although I will say, as much as we may have grown tired, as tired as we may have grown of the kind of monotony of, okay, it's a big obstacle course and then some crazy puzzle, I actually really liked this one where they start off with the American Ninja Warrior kind of like leaping panels. I don't know what they're called. Sorry. That was a cool and original, I think, kind of start to the challenge, at least something we hadn't seen in a while. They're going up various levels, and they end up at the top of like some multi-story kind of thing. It was for something we've seen 100 times. It somehow stood out to me. I thought that was good.
Yeah. As a final thought on Sarah's mission quickly. I'm grateful to her, first of all, for enlisting Tony in the first place. A little confused as to what that was meant to accomplish, other than maybe to entertain the viewers, in which case, great job, Sarah. Thank you. But I love that Tony, because she knows, you know, when you bring Tony in, you get what you pay for, basically. I love that Tony somehow covers her entire face in ash and leaves the rest of her uncovered. So anyone who's waking up in the middle of the night because the torches are rustling around is going to see these disembodied white limbs just floating in space. And probably be aware that something is up, you know, despite Sarah's marvelous facial camouflage.
Yes. I'm not sure how effective the camouflage would have been, but yeah, very good stuff, if for no reason other than TV. So returning to the immunity challenge, sorry for skipping ahead, but a couple things that I thought were funny. Wendell lines up on the starting mat and yet again has his toothpick in his mouth, and I'm like terrified that he's about to choke midway through this challenge, although they did thankfully include the shot of him spitting it out just before the challenge began, so my beating heart could be still and not worried.
Maybe this is why he's been so totally invisible this season, is so that when he gets medevaced through some horrible toothpick incident, we're not going to feel emotionally attached to him.
I think that's within the realm of possibility. And I wanted to correct something that I brought up last week. We're going to see Sandra sit out of the challenge yet again. I had said she had sat out of 12 challenges. That was incorrect. The all-time record for sitting out of challenges on Survivor is Courtney Yates, who has sat out of 12 challenges, and Sandra now is actually one back of that. And so history in the making potentially in these next couple of weeks, but it really is incredible. As the stat was flagged up by Jeff Pittman, and I think it was Courtney herself who tweeted out the fact that she sat out of 12 challenges in only two appearances on Survivor, whereas this is Sandra's fourth time and she's barely catching up. It is incredible that she could play two seasons and sit out of 12 pre-merge challenges. And granted, the Heroes versus Villains pre-merge went a while, but that I mean, that is astounding.
It really is, and we are never going to see that record broken. She will hold it for time immemorial.
No, I think we're about to see it broken, as Sandra, but it's certainly not broken in two seasons, yeah. But it's just incredible, because the way it worked back then is, instead of the rule being you can't sit out of back-to-back challenges, which should obviously be the rule, in Heroes versus Villains, it was just one, and the same way it is here, it's just one challenge per episode, and they changed it so you can only sit out once per episode. But in Courtney's case, that meant she could sit out 100% of challenges for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, we just finished China and got to see Courtney for a full 39 days. I would not blame them in Heroes versus Villains for being eager to let Courtney not do the physically demanding parts. If you are the producers, I would be very nervous about Courtney burning too many calories, so I'd be just fine with her sitting out of the challenges.
I think there's a good movie plot in here somewhere where you have Sandra and Courtney, Rice and Beans, these two amazing friends, both competing for the same title of who can sit out the most challenges in all of Survivor. And just that competition drives a wedge between them, and they have to reckon with their desire to chase that prize with what their friendship really means to them.
Yes, I'm signed up for that one for sure. Sandra is really the mouthpiece for all of the audience here as this challenge really comes down to the wire. The red team pulls away at first, but once it becomes puzzle time, Rob and Michelle seem to make up a lot of ground, and at least based on the TV edit, and this is a very difficult puzzle to make look any closer or further apart than it actually is, it appears that this blue team was literally one piece away from a pretty amazing comeback. But Sarah and Sophie are going to get this tree puzzle done here for the red team, and we're going to see yet another blue team tribal council, Dom. So I guess before we get into that, were you surprised at all, I suppose, to see Rob put himself back in the crunch time puzzle position?
I wasn't surprised. Someone like Rob is never really going to be able to admit that he's past his prime and that someone else should be stepping in instead. And then also, like, he historically has been very, very good at challenges, and especially the puzzle. So if, you know, if I'm Rob and the last 11 out of 12 times I've nailed the challenge, and the last one time, you know, I can easily write that off as just, oh, well, I had a bad day or whatever. But when it's your dude, you suck today, every single time, then it starts to become a problem.
Yeah, I think next week it may be a little ambitious if he says, no, no, I'm definitely the puzzle guy. After actually, he made up a bunch of time in the puzzle this week, so I feel like he has every case in the world to keep being the puzzle guy, and well, I agree with you. That, yeah, everyone's going to have an off day from time to time.
Well, also, maybe the story here isn't Rob has lost his mojo, it's that Sophie is just amazing at puzzles, because this is the second week in a row now where she's set up a play and ended up killing it.
Well, again, they had an enormous lead entering that puzzle, and Rob and Michelle made up a ton of time on the puzzle.
Why do you hate Sophie, Colin?
They made up about 3 seconds too few on the puzzle, but did a very good job overall there. But yeah, I guess we are going back here to the blue camp. I would love to have gotten to see another look at how the inner kind of politics of the red team that has been winning most of these challenges. And I am kind of rooting for a swap for that reason in particular, where if we think back through the challenges, it is only because Jeremy had an incredible ring toss performance that this blue team has even won a single one of them.
Yeah. And so for you, is there any appeal in seeing like a Matt Singh reboot all over again? Or would you prefer to see this space out a little more evenly?
I would definitely not want to see a Matt Singh reboot all over again. I think in a season like All Winners, letting this, as much as I like all the people in this kind of new school alliance that became the majority this week, and I think would probably continue to be the majority for as long as this tribe remains a thing, that is not what I want out of the All Winners season. I would definitely want to see some sort of mix-up.
It seems like Fate is playing a cruel trick on Denise, where after going to every single tribal council in her first season, she finally gets a taste of safety this time, and maybe the curse is lifted, and maybe I get to really play Survivor again, and get to just rest on my laurels for a few days if we don't lose a challenge. And it turns out that was the exception that proves the rule, and now she's just going to every single tribal again.
It could be the case that Denise turns out to be like the Courtney Yates of going to tribal council, where we look up at the end of the season and it's like, hang on, Denise went to 29 tribal councils in 2 seasons?
Yeah, weighing in with a 96% attendance record is Denise Safely.
That could be pretty incredible. But yeah, all right, let's get into it here, Dom. We get a little setup in terms of how things will play out on the blue team early on, where Adam goes to Ethan and says, I think Parvati could be the person that we're gunning for. And Ethan, understandably, gets a confessional saying, I can't believe he's telling me this. Obviously, Parvati is one of my closest allies. That's really dumb of him. And Adam, I would have been super terrified for Adam if he were not getting confessionals along the way, as he does the same thing with Rob. And Rob gives a similar sentiment to Ethan, like, kid, what are you doing telling me that you want to come for my number one ally? But Adam gets to lay it out and says, essentially, telling people these almost weirdly honest kind of truths at strategic points along the way can be very helpful. And to return to something you brought up earlier, Dom, and I thought was really important, and now is the time that I think it is an enormous consideration, I think Adam banking on there being a swap after this vote is immensely important to keep in mind when looking through his behavior here, and I think explains a lot. Like, if I were in Adam's shoes, I would be not 100% sure, but it would be so overwhelmingly likely that we are about to swap based on everything I could possibly feel like is reasonable at this point in the history of Survivor, that playing with any other priorities in mind would be crazy to me. And when I think we are going to swap tomorrow, for sure, the place that I want to be is on reasonable enough terms with as many people as I possibly can entering that swap, so that if I draw the same color buff as anyone, as many people as I can muster on this tribe, I will feel good about that. And I think this makes, frankly, a lot of sense from Adam's perspective if he is dealing with someone other than Boston Rob. Like, I think if he were dealing with Tyson, like we saw early on, when Tyson was more than willing to, hey, if you want to go for Amber and Kim, that's totally fine with me, I just want to make the swap. I think Adam approaching Rob and telling him this is essentially, as far as, like, what it should be indicating to Rob is Adam has no reason to lie to you. It would be insane for him to do this if his priority were anything other than wanting to keep you safe and working with you long term. And it just seems to me that the reason this backfired so hard is Boston Rob was not thinking to himself, I just need to make it to the swap on good terms with as many people as possible. Boston Rob was thinking to himself, I will run the show or I will not be here.
Yeah, and Rob was making fun of Adam for having the audacity to think that he, Rob, could be adaptable in the way that Adam was saying he needed to be. I was almost like, hey, look, you've seen every episode. You've seen 4 seasons of me playing. What do you think I'm going to do? Of course I'm not going to go with the flow and actually try and take a back seat for the first time in my life. And yeah, I think Adam, there's this weird dynamic where because Rob knows that Adam knows that, Rob should know that, of course, this is more likely to be sincere from Adam. Like, Adam's not just pulling some bluff on him for no reason. Like, there's just, it is even less likely than it would be otherwise because, you know, he's seen how Rob plays. Suggesting this to him, knowing how well it's probably going to go down, which is not very well at all, just seems suicidal unless you know, Adam feels desperate or Adam really believes that this is the right move and wants Rob there at his side for it. So if anything, this should increase his level of confidence in Adam. But yeah, as you say, Rob knows that if Rob knows that a swap is coming, it would make a lot of sense for him to, for the first time maybe in recorded Survivor history, not try and exert control over a vote. And for his admittedly very good act with Adam, where he's like, okay, fine, okay, am I going to be protected? I'll do it, but I need to know that I'm protected. I thought that was a great act. And if that was actually, if he was doing that, then great. But it turns out that was all a ruse. And instead, Rob is going to say it's my way or the highway. And yeah, it turns out it's the highway.
There's no question that Rob going the path that he did has hurt both him and Adam in a situation where Adam was only trying to benefit both of them entering a likely swap this upcoming round.
Yeah, and so from Adam's perspective, there's this question of reading the room and knowing your audience. And so, yeah, it behooves Rob to be more adaptable, possibly like Adam himself, even. If Rob wants to ascend into that hallowed pantheon, he really needs to up his game. But you know, because you are a super duper fan and you've seen Rob play so often, that he just doesn't do this. Even the one time when he was definitively on the outs but still in the game in Heroes vs. Villains, it seems like he wasn't really intending to like throw Courtney under the bus, which really would have appealed to Coach, who was hell-bent on voting for her anyway for some reason. Or he didn't try to strike some kind of compromise or maybe go after one of the lesser targets instead just to maybe woo Jerry back into the fold. He was adamant, it's going to be me or Russell. And that's just how it is. And it's boom or bust, and either I will be out of the game or I will be back in control of the game. And I think it makes sense for Rob to have that as his philosophy because his game operates based on fear, right? It's a double-pronged attack. It's if you are not with me, then you really have legitimate reason to be scared of me. But if you're on my side, I offer you protection and I go to fight for my people. And I think you need both halves of that offer to be in place for everybody to flock to Rob's banner as they have done for 4 seasons now, basically. So I can understand why he might think, well, let's say I give in and I vote out Pavdi. Well, now Ethan has no reason to trust me. And if it gets back to anyone else that I sold out Pavdi to buy myself some more time, then they would get it. But at the same time, it's so incongruous with what my game is that I'm just sunk. There's no way I can get back in charge, which is where I have to be.
Yeah.
So I get it. And so for Adam, you know that Rob is not going to adapt. Like you know that's not going to happen. So as much as I get the impulse of wanting to keep Rob close, especially with a swap, it really feels like to me, if he thinks he can't work with Rob or Pavdi, it makes sense to go after one of them. He seemed to think, though, that Rob was pretty tight with him and that he had a good working relationship with Rob, which is curious because I said the week before, typically you know where you stand with Rob, right? You may not know your exact spot in the pecking order, but you know that on that binary question of are you with him or are you against him, that you can answer that question. Whereas with Adam, it seemed like he thought he was much closer to Rob than Rob thought he was.
I think that's why he was so willing to be so blunt with him, is because he thought, Rob and I have a really good thing going. And I don't believe at all that he thought Rob is going to be happy about what I'm about to say to him, but I do think he thought Rob is going to trust that I am being honest and have his best long-term interest in mind, and he will, if presented this argument through the lens of, we are almost surely about to swap next week, and if we just, you know, tomorrow, not next week, like after this vote, there is a overwhelming chance we are going to swap, and if we just do this, we will all feel good about each other entering that swap.
Yeah, so for Adam, when he's calling on Rob to be adaptable, yes, he should be, but you, for you, knowing that he will not be, you then have to adapt to that. You can't just say, well, if it's very reminiscent of what everyone says when they're voted out, right? As well, if people were just playing the game properly, then they would have agreed with me. And there may be some truth to that this time. However, you have to know who you're talking to, and it seemed like that just wasn't really happening here.
I agree that he should have been probably a little more nervous about the prospect of Boston Rob just being hard out and mounting some kind of counterattack. But I would definitely understand saying to myself, if there were ever a time that Boston Rob were willing to take a back seat, it would be in a situation like this, right, where I can't possibly be lying to him. And I know the votes are locked in. My side has the majority no matter what Rob does. I am sincerely just trying to help him here with this. And it seems to me, Dom, that he just is wholly unwilling to play that role even for one round.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So I guess let's get into the idea of the people really calling the shots here. This Rob and Adam dynamic is the catalyst for the way a lot of this is going to go down, but it's both of them who are going to be left out of the ultimate plan, which is this Michelle, Jeremy, Ben, and Denise foursome recognizing, okay, as long as Rob and Adam are against each other, the four of us completely control the votes. We want to take a shot at this old school trio that has been doing a lot lately around running the game. We want to weaken Rob. Why not just go for Rob here, Dom?
So the question is, who are you? Are you Jeremy? Are you your beloved Michelle Fitzgerald? Who are you in this hypothetical?
I would guess, let's take this from the Jeremy and Michelle perspective, because they seem to be the ones at least painted as the decision makers.
Okay, and I think there is then the next question of which of Jeremy and Michelle are you? Because I think they have different incentives there.
So do you think it is much better for one of them in particular to leave Rob in?
So the feedback from the viewing party that the two of them held in Boston was that apparently both of them wanted to work with Rob and Parvati as a duo, but Jeremy was very keen to keep around Rob. Michelle wanted to work with Parvati. And so if, you know, the two of you who are the a really tight pair are fundamentally at odds with that, why not compromise? Why not hit them with Edgardo and go for Ethan instead? And you keep your alliance happy. You take out someone who, like, if you're Jeremy, what use does Ethan really serve to you, right? You take this piece out of the game that's maybe no use to you, and you leave in someone who, now that Ethan is not there, is going to be more tightly bonded to you because they don't have as many options anymore, I guess is the idea. And then plus, for Jeremy, it seems like he is very successfully reprising his meat shield strategy from Cambodia, where if you can just keep around these bigger targets, which Ethan definitely is not, and Rob and Parvati definitely are, especially as a duo, then you can just coast by and bide your time until you make your move to seize control. So that makes a lot of sense for him. For Michelle, I think it makes a lot more sense to just go after Rob, and that's why she was advocating for that. On the other hand, though, you know how tight Parvati and Ethan are, too. You know, Ethan was at Parvati's wedding, or maybe vice versa, although I'm pretty sure that's the right way around.
Is Ethan married?
We'll check. We'll toss that into touch for now and check back on it later. But either way, like, you know, the two of them are super tight, so I guess taking out Ethan means that the same logic applies. Parvati has to be closer to you because, you know, who else does she have? So it kind of makes sense from that perspective. But yeah, by and large, if you're just thinking about it in terms of how do we weaken Rob, the best way to weaken Rob is to vote Rob out of the game.
And I would be particularly nervous, again, to return to what I believe is such a fundamentally crucial idea when approaching this round in particular. And maybe we will show up next week and there won't be a swap, but I think you have to it would be crazy not to assume when casting these votes that we will swap after this round, and I would be nervous about leaving Boston Rob in the game in a position where we have just scorned him and he's about to draw a new buff and know that now is his moment to build a new coalition with this fresh team.
Yeah, I don't know how well it works to have Rob as a meat shield when that meat shield is on the warpath against you because yeah. You just burned his closest friend. So that's a downside of that. Also, it's just, you know that there's no effective, like, tribe management here. You know that Rob, if you leave him in the game, I don't think he has the same, like, Natalie Anderson or Sandra mentality of, I will seek vengeance at all costs, but he definitely is going to get revenge if he can help it at all. So it really feels like they are playing with fire there, just assuming that Rob will play ball.
I mean, I really can't remove the idea from my mind that everybody would have been so much better off if Rob had just listened to Adam entering this probable swap.
Mm. Yeah, if everyone just listens to Adam for the rest of time, humanity will be much better off.
That's not even necessarily what I'm saying, although I do think Adam seems to have some good ideas in the real world as well, but like, it is just incredible to me, and I don't think it's all Boston Rob's fault. I'm certainly not trying to say Adam did nothing wrong, but I also, like, from both Adam and Rob's perspectives, and also this foursome that is blindsiding both sides of this kind of internal war at camp, I, assuming we will swap next week, don't see how. This is going to be a group, unless it's this Michelle, Jeremy, Ben, and Denise crew all swapping onto the same tribe, that is going to be cohesive at all or feel good about each other at all. It now feels to me like maybe Michelle and Jeremy feel good about each other, but I'm not sure if there's another pair other than probably Boston Rob and Parvati who have just been left on the outs by themselves that are going to feel good about each other now going into the swap, and that is the opposite of what you want.
And some of that is unavoidable, but part of it was by design, where they leave Adam out of this Ethan vote, they blindside him, they drive a wedge between him and Denise, which is an effective short-term tactic for sure, but it also means that, let's say, you're Jeremy or you're Michelle, and you get swapped onto a tribe with Adam, he's going to be a lot less inclined to trust you now that he was left out of that. So that feels like a risk, but maybe it's a worthwhile one. But yeah, Adam finds himself once again back in the same spot he was at the start of Millennials versus Gen X, where he's on the outs and now has to just work his way back in, and he's very good at doing that. But it's been a roller coaster for him so far, for sure.
Yeah, if we do end up not swapping, would you imagine that Rob and Parvati would be the people on the outs if this tribe lost another challenge, or do you think Adam could potentially be under the gun, or someone else?
That's an interesting one. I assume that at this point, if you break up that pair, the other one is this loose cannon, this wild card that you've left in the game. But that's going to be true no matter who you break up. Like, if you break up Adam and Denise, the same could go for one of them. You break up Jeremy and Michelle. Like, the only safe option in that regard maybe is Ben, who no one seems to trust fully. And even though he's been making these constant overtures to Adam and Denise, they don't seem happy that that he knows about their idol, that they have to keep giving him information. No one seems to want Ben there, even though he seems to just be happy to go along for the ride.
Yeah, that could definitely be one scenario. It's just, I can't get over just the idea that it really seemed to me like Adam was coming from the perspective of, I feel really good about my personal relationship with Rob, but clearly this new school group of players is not interested in letting these old schoolers stick around. I'm going to go to Rob and loop him in and try to make him feel better, and knowing that there is no realistic scenario where he can turn this around on me. Like, this other side will control the votes, knowing Denise has the idol and not being too concerned about anything else at this point. It's wild to me what a mess this tribe has ultimately become when it really seemed like all of the opportunity was there for a very cohesive vote this time around.
What did you make of Rob just calling Jeremy and Michelle out on their bullshit, just not even letting them go through the motions of faking what their conversation was about, and just saying, look, I know what's going on, and this is what we're doing now, just really again, making himself the alpha and showing his dominance.
Michelle beginning with the kind of like fake lie as Jeremy's just like grinning from ear to ear, knowing that they've been blown up, was incredible. But yeah, I
have given over the course of his two seasons mixed reviews to Jeremy at various points, but him just like winking to Robin saying don't worry, Pav safe, absolutely killed me. That was fantastic.
Yeah, that, I mean, Jeremy was amazing in that moment. But I to me, that's one such situation where I'm a big fan of the Adam Klein style, just like blunt honesty. Like I don't know the actual dynamics in terms of if Rob ever really had a chance to flip things around to make it go his way. I would guess the answer to that is no, which is why I am kind of a fan of what Adam was attempting in the first place. Like, he's, as far as I can tell, extending the olive branch, saying, hey, everyone else is against you. I am the one guy in this majority alliance you can trust. Here is the scoop, and we can feel great about each other when we almost invariably swap tomorrow morning. I would imagine in a situation where pretty much no matter what happens, it's going to be Michelle and Jeremy controlling the vote no matter what. I am a fan of being just kind of honest with the Boston Rob person in that situation and not needlessly getting their hopes up.
Yeah, and this is one of those spots where, on the surface, this episode doesn't really seem to make any sense. You know, Adam is going haywire, and then the eventual vote, not only the logic behind it seems a little strange, but then also it comes basically completely out of left field. The only indication we have is that short scene on the beach where Michelle and Jeremy are talking, and Michelle says, oh, I guess Ethan's a possibility too. And that's it. And everything else is focused around poverty. And so going into that vote, the 40-minute mark, I was solidly assuming that, okay, it has to be Adam or poverty. And then the first Ethan vote comes up, and I'm like, hello? On the surface, it's a weird episode, and part of that is by design, because they chose to obscure the logic behind it. But when you dive deeper, I think you see why everybody did what they did, even though maybe it's a mistake or a bad risk on balance, and even though it's definitely going to blow up in some of their faces, which is exactly what you want to see.
I would never dream of asking anyone to do this research, but for the last couple weeks, I've been working on a theory that was tested during the Danny vote, and it passed that test. My theory is the person who has the first vote come out of the bucket almost never leaves. And the last 2 weeks it's been Parvati, whose name has come out first from the bucket. And entering this vote, I was thinking to myself, it seems almost too obvious that it's going to be Adam. Like, I don't buy that Adam is actually about to leave right now, but I would buy him getting the majority of votes on him and Denise potentially idling him. I could see being a situation in play, especially when early on in the episode they highlighted that Denise had been her idol has been made whole. And then I was definitely thinking Parvati was in the mix. It wasn't until the final commercial break before the tribal council that Ethan even crossed my mind. I sent a message to Brian Scally because I knew he was definitely watching live and I didn't want to spoil it for anyone else. I could see him tweeting up a storm as usual on Wednesday nights. And I sent him the message essentially saying, I don't think it's Adam, but if it is Adam, I don't know if I can even show my face on the podcast this week. If, like, everything that I've been complimenting Adam on about being, like, years ahead of his time and this kind of blunt honesty being the future of Survivor, if that is, like, directly what leads to his undoing on this Winter of War season, Winners at War season, I'm not sure I can even show up this week. And Scally was the one who flagged up to me that Ethan was even a possibility. And from that point, I did start thinking to myself, oh, that could make a ton of sense. And so when the first vote came up for Ethan and it clicked to me that four votes would still be a majority if the other four were split 3-1, it all sank in very, very quickly for me, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So just quickly, what do you make of anything that's going on the other tribe at the moment, where there are so many people, because they've just been winning so much and they haven't had to really do anything or be part of any drama themselves, we just haven't got to hear from them at all. So Kim was literally not in this episode, as far as I could tell. Right? Maybe her her face was in the background for a frame or two at the challenge.
I caught a glimpse of Kim at the challenge, yes.
Okay. So that's your weekly Kim watch. And then Wendell and Nick have both been quiet all season, essentially, but even more so here. So it would make a bit of sense if, you know, they just the first vote they took part in, they didn't really have a big part to play. Nothing has really happened involving them since then, and they haven't been to Tribal. So it's after this swap that maybe is coming this week where we're going to see them leap into action finally, or have to leap into action. But for now, it's got to be weird if you're like a Wendell fan, or I guess there are maybe some Nick fans out there too. If you're a Wendell fan and you've been waiting to see him come back and play this all winter season, you're jazzed to see him there. This has got to be an odd experience so far.
I would take at least some comfort, though, in the knowledge that his tribe is winning almost all of the challenges, and he does seem to be, for both Nick and Wendell, I would say, are firmly in the majority alliance, as far as I could tell, if that tribe did end up going back to another vote. Like, as far as the red tribe dynamics are concerned, I would have, at this point, still no reason not to believe in that Nick, Wendell, Yule, and Sophie group. Is that roughly the page you're on?
That sounds right to me, yeah.
Yeah, all right, so I definitely would want to see more from Wendell, but if there is a time that it's okay to be a little more under the radar, a little further beneath the radar, I guess, this is definitely the time of the season for that to be the case. Dom, anything else before we hop into the edit zone briefly?
I think that's about it. It was a really interesting week and a really interesting vote. But for some reason, I'm not shedding tears over it, Colin. I don't understand why.
That's right. Shame on me for skipping over all of this in terms of just parting thoughts on losing Ethan. Dom, tell the people, why do you hate Ethan Zahn? Why do you love cancer?
It's not that I hate him. It's just that I don't understand why everybody else is so enamored with him. I get that he's a very handsome young man who says and maybe a silver fox now, who says his pleases and thank yous. That doesn't make him the Messiah, but apparently it does to 99% of the people out there.
So you just feel the hype has gone way too far on Ethan?
I think he is completely inoffensive, which almost to an offensive degree, where I can't find anything to dislike about him. And I like my people to have a bit of a kick. I like my character flaws, you know? I like have something to root for and something to root against, and there just is none of that with Ethan, and it's very, very irritating to me.
Well, what character flaws would you identify in Ceri Fields or Kim Spradlin that you find very rootable?
Okay, what I want is a distinct personality of some kind, which is so far very lacking from what we saw of Ethan on the screen. And apparently, Ethan, you know, when he was working the Survivor charity party circuit back in the day, was a lot more mischievous than people give him credit for. So that's great, but I would want to see some of that. And instead we get this very bland Ethan who no one could possibly hate, aside from me, though I still don't hate him, Colin, and everyone could only love. And that's just dull. Gotta mix it up a bit.
I agree it is a bit monotonous, but at the same time, if you're going to just be constantly viewed in one mode, I think sweetest man on the planet is not a bad one.
Is he the sweetest man on the planet, or does he just not say or do anything that anyone could possibly object to?
So
is he nice?
Are you positing that this is in any way a ruse on Ethan's part? That he does that if given truth serum, we would be seeing an entirely different side of Ethan? Because to me, the reason it is so effective is because it seems so sincere. I don't think this is anything you could fake.
I'm not saying that at some point the mask is coming off and we're going to see what really lies beneath. I'm saying that it's just, where's the beef, you know? What am I actually meant to be drawn to here?
So I think it's been a while since I've gone down this road, so why not? To me, like, Dan Giesling is overtly just a bullshit artist. Like, he is a con man with the way he treats people, and Ethan is a genuine version of what Dan wishes he could do with people.
Okay, what I'm saying is there are many, many people out there who are also seemingly pretty nice, good people. They don't get the same level of messianic fervor that Ethan gets. Where there was a clip of that same watch party where, you know, as they were reading the votes, it was reminiscent of the Malcolm boot in Game Changers that we were there for, the live know-it-alls, just people screaming, crying. There was this there was one girl who on every single Ethan vote let out a distinct wail, even though past the second or third one, like, she knew what was coming, but that didn't change how she reacted. It's just, I don't get it. Fill me in, someone, please.
Ethan, I think the major thing is just, what's not to like about Ethan? And I think for you, the answer is, it's boring that it's constantly the same kind of reaction to Ethan. There's nothing, the fact that there's nothing to dislike is itself something to dislike about Ethan.
That about sums it up pretty well. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that seems very fair of you. Dom, if we're going to be the pro-Ben Dreebergen podcast, we're really pushing it with being the anti-Ethan Zahn podcast as well.
Look, Ethan is the Wendell's Ready Confessional for Chris Holland of Survivor contestants. Like, yeah, it's fine, but it's nothing to write home about.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's go from one easy Ethan Zahn to a different easy, the Edit Zone, Dom, where we're going to be getting a little further. You like that one? That was a good one. We're going to be getting a little further into the specific edit of the cast that we've gotten to see so far. Before we do that, I know not everyone is in love with that sort of thing, so if you want to tune out, now would be the time. He is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. Email the show, domandcolin@gmail.com, and find bonus episodes over at patreon.com/domandcolin, where we are just about wrapped up with China. The final episode has been recorded and not edited yet, but that will be up soon. And then we are on to a couple of non-Survivor things after that. The Mole and Big Brother 8 seem to be next in line. So with all of the regular Survivor stuff that we're doing on the main feed, thought this would be a good time for some extracurriculars over there. So patreon.com/DomandColin for bonus episodes. Dom, anything else?
No, that's all good.
All right, let's go to the edit zone. Oh, wait, what?
Follow us on Twitter, I suppose.
I did say that. All right, thank you for paying attention, Dom. Let's just go to the edit zone now.
You are listening to the Dom and Colin Edit Zone.
Mike Holloway.
Michelle Ken. Brad Culpepper. Rob and Sandra.
You are listening to the Dom and Colin
Edit Zone.
What are you doing?
Tune out now.
All right, here we are in the edit zone. And Dom, since we may never get another opportunity like this, I feel it would be irresponsible of us to begin anywhere other than, just for old time's sake, a little Michelle Fitzgerald winner edit discussion. I would say a big week here for Michelle, really being the mouthpiece of this kind of galaxy brain plan to get rid of Ethan. I'm guessing she stood out to you as well?
Yeah, hard to deny how good this week was for her, as much as I might like to.
Okay. What is with you and just hating on everyone that people like a lot?
I mean, Michelle is still a somewhat controversial figure, unlike Ethan, who is, you know, who came down from heaven to I guess he's Jewish, but he existed.
I don't know if I want to keep going down this route.
I'm not going to dig my hole any deeper. Let's circle back to Michelle's edit here, which was, you know, she had an excellent week. And I don't know if this is the week that, like, put her on the map, or if this is, you know, because in Kerrang, we were highlighting Michelle because there, it seemed like there was no earthly reason for her to be getting the focus that she was getting unless she was going to go on to win, which she did. This time around, if you believe the narrative that they sold us, she was really in the mix for this vote, putting a lot of pressure on it to go a certain way. And so yeah, it would make perfect sense for her to get some of the focus there. However, you could easily imagine, like, if Jeremy goes on to win, they could find a way to assign him credit for that instead. So does Michelle's edit this episode really stand out to you, or is it just a promising sign that we need more data on?
It is certainly possible that they are just balancing their range better and decided to feature Michelle here. But yeah, what it would come down to me is I would at the very least feel better about Michelle than most other people within that group that voted in the majority, because I do feel like if Jeremy, for instance, were our eventual winner here, it would be quite likely that this would be painted a lot more through his perspective. And the fact that it is routinely Michelle who is setting up why we're doing what we're doing and is getting another confessional this week on top of the one she got in the premiere about how people didn't appreciate her first win, and she's here to prove that she deserved it. And I feel like there is a lot of reason to be believing in Michelle after this week. And furthermore, I've just been very happy with what I've seen out of Michelle as a player out there. I think she is understandably not someone who's on a ton of people's radars at this point, and that is going to make it easier for her than others, especially early on in the game. But from what I have seen, she seems to be doing a really strong job here, making sure people feel good about her and staying in the majority. And I would anticipate that there are not going to be too many like disaster swap draws for a Michelle Fitzgerald type, assuming we do eventually swap here. So yeah, I think it would be crazy not to have Michelle pretty near the top of the list at this point.
Yeah, and this might be a case where if Jeremy is trying to use Rob and Parvati as his meat shields, Michelle's using Jeremy as hers, right?
Yeah.
Like, if he gets a lot of the blowback from that vote and she's able to come away with her hands clean, then she might be in a great spot.
Do they have turducken in England, where it's like a turkey inside, it's like a chicken inside of a turkey inside of a duck, from smallest to largest? I gave the wrong order, but I feel like she's the meat shield within the meat shield within the meat shield.
That sounds abominable, but she is the very middle matryoshka doll in this whole setup. But yeah, I wonder how well this vote is going to go down with Adam. Like, maybe she's burned a bridge there by not letting him in. But yeah, I think it's going to be hard for Michelle to swap that badly, and that's all you can really ask for at this stage.
Yeah. All right. So I guess let's do this kind of tribe by tribe, because I think that makes sense in terms of just kind of voting block by voting block here on the blue tribe. I certainly am not ruling Jeremy, Ben, or Denise out by any stretch, just because Michelle got to do most of the mouthpiecing for why the vote ended up going that way. But to go back to what we were talking about with Michelle, I would have probably expected more from any of those three in this particular vote if they were the eventual winner. Am I letting the sky fall too quickly here, Dom?
Just say those three people again.
Jeremy, Denise, and Ben, who were in on this vote but did not get nearly as much as Michelle in terms of explaining it.
I could see that, yeah. I mean, especially for Denise with that, you know, although I could see, let's say we get in here next week and we are explaining the Ethan vote, which I, you know, came as a surprise to the viewers as well as Adam. Maybe it's going to be Denise saying, I didn't want to keep this from Adam, but I felt like I had to for the sake of appeasing the other people in my group or something. So maybe she has to lay low because her, you know, giving her any kind of ability to explain her role would just spoil the outcome before it's happened.
Yeah, I could see certainly any of the three of them still very much being in the mix for sure. And, you know, the editors have certainly made a fool of me enough times over the years now that they are willing to balance their range a bit more, that I am nowhere near willing to say anything like conclusively about this foursome. It just is a spot where I feel like the person they choose to highlight is generally going to be pretty important here, but still feeling plenty fine about all of Jeremy, Ben, and Denise being in the mix, drawing live. And I would also say about Adam, who was voting all by his lonesome here, it is certainly not good to be the guy who has no one else voting along the same lines as him, and everyone is essentially lying about how things are going. But if we do swap next week, I would at least be willing to hear arguments that there's, if you can't be in a situation where you just feel good about as many people as possible, I would at least be willing to entertain the idea that not owing anything to anyone, which is the case for Adam now, everyone has just lied to him, is not a bad spot at all to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
All right, so I'm definitely still feeling like Adam can recover here, and certainly no stranger to getting just destroyed by the editors, even in seasons where he wins for an episode or two at the very least. How are you feeling about Rob and Parvati at this point? Still for the moment on this tribe, are we feeling like they are still people in whom to be believing, or are they just kind of at the mercy of a swap or no swap situation?
Is it just me, or has Parvati seemed surprisingly low key given her status coming in, and also how under the spotlight she is already within the game?
I feel like Parvati has been plenty visible, but given the kind of dynamics on the tribe, I'm not sure if I could realistically be feeling any better about Parvati right now, given that she is kind of on the outs here. This old school group have made themselves a big target. I know originally the plan was to eliminate Parv until Adam spilled the beans, and then we kind of had to take that out of consideration. But from a purely edit perspective, I am definitely still very much buying Parvati. And maybe this is me just talking myself into it because I've already lost half of my team from the auction draft we did, and I'm already down to only Michelle and Parvati, so that could be playing a role here. But I am still for sure a believer in Parvati, particularly with a possible swap on the horizon here, having no problem recovering.
Okay, I can yeah. see it.
How about Rob? Do you feel like Rob has a path to victory here?
I don't know. I feel like... I don't know what I meant to think about Rob. Was this episode a good look for him, would you say?
It's so tough. For me personally, I would say definitely not. But I do not expect them to expect the average Survivor viewer to think like I do, if that makes sense. Where I think for the average casual, they probably liked what they saw out of Boston Rob. I'm sure I know Anna, casual Anna, the great friend of the podcast... Rob can do no wrong, and I would guess that is the case for most people viewing the show.
Right. It's like, well, Adam is an idiot, and, you know, Rob skillfully navigated this really tough situation. So, yeah, go Rob. He's doing great.
Yeah. And by the way, casual Anna, based on her sending me her thoughts as she watches these episodes, she will find out as she listens to this podcast, but up until this week still thinks Ben's name is Dan.
Of course. I would expect nothing less.
Yeah. But yeah, as far as I can tell from the casual perspective, Rob can do no wrong. And I'm guessing that will be roughly the messaging that the show ends up going with. And that's why I was so confused during season 39 when Rob and Sandra would be getting so much stuff way, way wrong. It seemed mind-blowing to me that the show would let them come across that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, let's move over to the other tribe, Dom. We haven't gotten to see nearly as much from this red tribe. I mentioned earlier that I am a believer in this new school, or this one-time player kind of foursome of not necessarily new school, but Yule, Sophie, Wendell, and Nick still being kind of the power hub if this tribe were to stay intact. Is anyone from within that group jumping out to you as the particular front runner?
Yule, I think, is certainly seems to be the most prominent of the group just in edit terms. I don't know if that's, you know, go back to first principles here. Would you expect your standards for what makes a good edit from for someone, is that different from, you know, is a good edit for Boston Rob different from a good edit for Michelle Fitzgerald, let's say, to use a very extreme example?
Yes, I think those are the examples I would have used as well. I think we talked a little bit about this last week, but Rob, I think, would get a solid baseline of content no matter what, whereas they would have no problem, I would guess, not featuring Michelle for several episodes in a row. And as things pertain to this Red Tribe, the example that has been coming up for me these last couple of weeks is the fact that Sophie is getting so much narration, and this was a slower week for her, but up until this point, I would have said she is the one who was jumping off the page at me in terms of, I would guess they do not feel even a slight compulsion to go out of their way to highlight Sophie unless there's a very real reason to do so. So she would be mm-hmm. the one that probably continues to jump off the page for me out of this, maybe this entire red team.
Yeah, I would co-sign all of that.
Yeah, and I don't know where Yule would land in that mix, though, because I would imagine he would be much more towards the Michelle and Sophie kind of end of the spectrum of they would not necessarily feel compelled to highlight this one-time player from 10, 15 years ago unless they really wanted the audience to know who he was and feel good about him.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't really know what to make of that. I guess Yule could be poised for a deep run. Maybe he's going to be a winner candidate. The way he is, though, he doesn't have the braggadocious nature of a Boston Rob, right? If Yule feels like he's in a good spot in the game, he's not going to be flaunting it. He's going to be calmly and methodically explaining it to the cameras. But then also, if he feels like he's in a bad spot in the game, he'll be calmly and methodically explaining it to the cameras. So I feel like Yule has much less of a range in terms of just his delivery and the way what he says comes across. So picking up on the overall impression we're meant to have of Yule is going to be a bit harder, I think.
So here's an important question for me as things pertain to Yule. I would probably say, depending on your answer to this, because I don't know, but I would have similar concerns about Jeremy and Ben along similar lines. Does Yule have kids?
I don't think he does.
Okay, that is the answer Yule fans should hope is the case, because if Yule had kids and we have not heard anything about them, I would be a lot more nervous about Yule, the same way not having heard, I don't think, very much about Jeremy or Ben's kids this time around is a big red flag for me, whereas we are getting to hear from Tyson or from Parvati, or I think Kim may have mentioned being a mom. Amber and Rob get to talk about having kids. I think that is enormously important. If it, like, one of my general fundamentals of reading the edit is, if the candidate has children and we're never hearing about it, you can pretty much write them off.
Yeah, and I think that was far less true as of, let's say, 5 years ago.
Yes.
But right now, it is just an absolute top priority.
Yeah, well, with that in mind, before we get into Tyson, who did get to talk about his kids, Tony and Sarah haven't gotten to talk much about their kids. Sandra hasn't gotten to talk much about her. Very bad sign for a lot of the people on this tribe in terms of the kid logic. But to quickly just touch back on that majority alliance and the lack of Nick and Wendell, while there is no better time to be quiet, I am pretty nervous about both Nick and Wendell and the lack of visibility on both of their parts, even though they are on the tribe that is winning the challenges and has Tony running around doing crazy stuff every single day. I do feel like we would see more of either of them if they were the eventual winner.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that.
Yeah, but I do think there are other people, you know, not hearing about their kids aside, still very much worth considering in this group. Tyson, despite being on the outs since very early on here, does continue to be in my winner mix, especially with a swap looming, and he could potentially be the guy on this team that doesn't really owe anything to anyone. Where are you on Tyson right now?
I think Tyson has a pretty decent shot. It would make a lot of sense to me for him to take control of some of those necessary scenes, talking about his kids and explaining his spot in the game, but then he's not running people out, and he's not taking part in too many of the antics going on this group. So he's going to take more of a back seat, but just be there, or just a constant presence with that classic Tyson snark. I think, yeah, Tyson is definitely in the mix for me.
Yeah, I agree. We've gotten plenty in terms of character development, and there hasn't been a big need for voting explanations from all of this kind of, what was, I believe, described in the premiere as the gritty crew of Tony, Sarah, and Sandra. Tony continues to really interest me. I have such a hard time allowing my mind to go to a place where Tony is able to make it through 39 days of a game of Survivor without people at a certain point saying, of course we need to get rid of Tony. But based on the edit, Dom, through these first 3 weeks, I keep feeling good about Tony. I would say I would have him at least in the top half of my winner candidates.
I'm not going to say no, but it would be a cruel irony if we spent so long conditioning ourselves to never get our hopes up with regards to Tony that on the one time where he might actually be in a decent spot, we're just automatically shoving him down into a different tier just so that we don't disappoint ourselves yet again.
Yeah, well, I feel like that is healthy. I don't want my expectations to get too out of hand as things pertain to Tony. I want every week to continue feeling like a total free roll. Every additional week of Tony I get is like bonus content at this point for me already. How do you feel about Sarah Lucina, who got another segment this week as she went and picked up that advantage? It seems like she's been plenty visible and had a chance to talk about her own perspective on pretty much everything important on this tribe.
What would you include in that, though? Like, what has been important?
Well, I mean, just given the lack of anything meaningful really happening here, getting confessionals along the way and getting her own kind of position within the tribe expanded upon, in that scene last week where she locks in Cops R Us again with Tony, that was a big deal to me at the time, and I continue to feel like that Tony and Sarah pair, maybe it was only brought up because of the heist mission they went on this week, but I continue to feel good about both Tony and Sandra, Tony and Sarah, and the relationship that between the two of them, I do buy being potentially important down the line.
Okay.
Yeah. And how about Sandra? Is she just on death row here waiting for her number to get called, or does she have a chance?
Again, we've seen her go and win after six episodes without a confessional, so it's going to be hard for me not to just repeat that statistic for all of the six episodes in this season where she doesn't get a confessional, if that ends up happening. So
yeah.
It's hard to be worse than that, given that she still won that season. So, she's still in the mix. Why not?
And how about, let's hope that Kim Spradlin is this season's person of the eventual winner who just randomly goes quiet for a while.
This is real quiet, though. This is a lot to handle.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. I've seen a popular question coming up this week. Where is Natalie Anderson in your mix of winner edit, like, power rankings? Like, for sure, for me, I would take Natalie Anderson over Kim or Nick or Wendell at this point. Where, if you were to, like, redraft people, how high would Natalie be going for you?
So, for me, she would be above all of the people who I've not eliminated, but they seem to be on life support after three episodes. She would definitely be above the Nick's Wilson and Wendell's Holland of the world.
Yeah, I would have a hard time probably even still putting her above like the Jeremy, Denise, Adam tier, but I definitely have an eye on Natalie Anderson, and that would be a pretty insane way for this all winter season to end up going. All right, Dom, anything else this week?
I'm all good, I think. How about you?
I believe that will do it. So thank you guys who have made it this far. Another thrilling week talking about Winners at War. I don't want to end this on too negative of a note, but I remain extraordinarily pessimistic about the future of Survivor from 41 and beyond. So I am really trying to cherish every week that we get to come in here and be this excited to talk about the show, because it really has been a treat.
Yeah, and I hope it comes across as well just how energized we are for the season in a way that, honestly, we really haven't been in a long time.
I mean, we got multiple comments over the last couple of weeks from people saying, oh, it's so refreshing having you guys feeling good and happy about watching Survivor and enjoying the season again. And I completely agree, but I want to make it clear, it's not like we have been coming in here for the last 3 years trying to be negative. We react to what the show gives us, and it's been
for yourself, Colin.
It's been terrible for five of the last six seasons. Like I know, again, I say I don't want to go out on a super negative note, but like I don't understand how anyone who is like, how you could be optimistic about the future of newbie seasons of Survivor, but let's not think about that right now. Let's focus on season 40 and cross that disastrous bridge whenever we get there. And in the meantime, I guess what I was trying to get at is just really enjoy our last few weeks here of guaranteed going to enjoy the current season of Survivor. So yeah, very fun and positive note to end things on for you guys this week. We will talk to you, I'm sure, after next week. Enjoy the new episode. Take care, everybody.